Okay. Welcome to our first public talk by Adam Brown. So today we had our first day of retreat.
Carry on.
And I think, Adam, it's time for you to talk now. You have 4.5 hours to sleep.
Yeah.
So after today, he's going to talk about Samatha and Vipassana meditation practices. Are these two different methods or two aspects of the same technique? So I think this is a piece of cake for him. So I'm going to give the mic to him to explain this.
Unfortunately, we can't eat cake in the afternoon. So what should I do? No, very good. And again, it's great to be back here again. Now, I did give a talk this morning, but I hadn't slept for about 2 days. So I had a very nice rest this afternoon. So I feel back to being a human being again. This morning, any talk I gave was just on autopilot. Today, I'm more here. So look, let's get this very clear straight away. Look, please, there is no difference between samatha and vipassana. Again, sometimes I get a bit sort of concerned that some of these teachings are put around. You wouldn't mind having tolerance to different ways of teaching, but some of those ways cause too many problems for people. And it means that they miss out on the beauty, the happiness, the great insights of meditating. So I'm going to begin with one of the stories. Samatha, if you don't know, is what's called making the mind nice and calm and peaceful and still. Number one, as I said this morning, you don't get to that stage by concentrating and being toe stiff. That just makes you more tight. You never get still. And I didn't mention this morning, I hold up a cup holder on here. You can't keep a glass of water still by holding it. I said this morning, I won't go through it again. You have to put it down and become still by itself. That is samatha, that is stillness. Letting things go. Stop being a control freak. If you're a control freak to others, people think you're a pain in the ass. If you're a control freak to yourself, concentrate, concentrate, then you're the biggest pain in your ass and anywhere else too. And for anybody who thinks, what is a Buddhist monk doing, say arse words or shit words, please have a look in such sutras, such teachings of the Buddha, as the Aranyabhanga Sutta and also the Vinaya. The Buddha said specifically, monks, you must teach the Dhamma, teach Buddhism in the local language. Okay. So, that's concentration. Concentration is nothing to do with Buddhism. I mentioned that this morning. Please get that out of your heads. Meditation is nothing to do with concentration. It's about being still. Number two, this idea that you do stillness first and then you do vipassana. And vipassana is a higher teaching. That again is nothing to do with Buddhism. It's a false teaching which causes people a lot of problems. And after that vipassana, you say, then you can become enlightened. But some people say, no, that's not enough. You have to go to the higher level after enlightenment. And then you do Ajahn Brahm's method. No, Ajahn Brahm's very good, but then do my method and you go even further. And further, and further. It's always, you know, trying to do better than everybody else. It's just conceit. My method is better than your method. So that, if you ever hear that anywhere in Buddhism, that this is the best method. This gets you further. Doubt that, please. That is not Buddhism. The way of Buddhism is always the Eightfold Path. Nothing else. Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. So anyone who comes along and says, this is the only way to enlightenment, vipassana, that is totally wrong. You can demonstrate that verse 372 of the Dhammapada, Ezo Wamako, Mati Anyu, Dasanasana Sutta. This is the only path, there is no other, for the purity of insight. And what is that path? eightfold path. Nothing else. Someone asked me, if you become a sower, what do you do next? Eightfold path. When you become a non-returner, what do you do next? Eightfold path. It's eightfold path all the way. That makes life very simple. In fact, Buddhism is a very simple teaching. People make it complicated. So, eightfold path. An eightfold path is samatha vipassana. It goes together. You can't get insight without being calm. You can't have calm without being insight. Having insight. There's something else also which happens. And this is where I develop the story of the husband and wife here in Toronto. The husband was called Sam. His surname was Atta, Sam Atta. His wife was called Vi, surname Pasana. So Sam Atta and Vi Pasana, they were married. And one day after lunch, they decided to have a nice walk up Meditation Mountain. And with them, they took their little dog, who was called Metta. So Sam Atta, Vi Pasana, and Metta the dog went on a walk up Meditation Mountain. And Sam, the reason he wanted to go on a walk up Meditation Mountain, because it was so peaceful out there. It was so calm. He loved that stillness on Meditation Mountain. Vi Pasana, she was a photographer. So she took her new camera, because she wanted to take these great insight shots on top of Meditation Mountain. She went up there for the view. And Metta the dog, what did she go up there for? You ask the dog, it's just fun, going up Meditation Mountain. Metta the dog was the wisest of them all. She didn't think so much. So Sam Atta, Vi Pasana, and Metta the dog started walking up Meditation Mountain. They got halfway, and even halfway up Meditation Mountain, it was so peaceful, so still. Sam was smiling. Halfway up Meditation Mountain, you could see a long way. So Vi Pasana was taking this inside shot, that inside shot. She was getting many insights on her camera. And Metta the dog, she was just wagging her tail. She was enjoying life halfway up Meditation Mountain. But when they got to the top of the mountain, wow, it was so still. Up Meditation Mountain, nothing moved up there. So Sam, oh, he was so happy. He could feel the stillness. But you know, Sam had a pair of eyes too. So he could also see the view. Vi Pasana, his wife, oh, you could see everything up there. The whole of the truth was laid out in front of him. Too much to really understand, so she's just taking insight of this, insight of that. But she could also experience incredible peace on top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog, have you ever seen a dog who's really ecstatic? Wagging its tail like it's going to fall off, running around in circles. Oh, Metta the dog was so happy. But even Metta the dog could experience the stillness. There was a story recently about this woman, I think it was from the US, it's on the internet, it's a great story. She came home with her shopping one day, and as she came into the house, her bags with hands with shopping, a dog ran past her and into her house. And, you know, she hadn't seen this dog before. So she put her shopping down and went to find out. By the time only 1 minute had passed, she saw the dog was curled up in a corner of a quiet room, fast asleep. And it wasn't a stray dog. It was this Labrador, had a collar, you know, well-groomed and clean. So she liked dogs. And out of compassion, okay, dog, I don't know where you come from. If you like to sleep there, that's fine with me. And after 2 hours of sleep, that little dog got up, barked very gently, and so she opened the door to let it out. Now somebody else's dog had come to sleep in her house. And the same thing happened the next day, and the day after. It was such a lovable dog, he didn't mind. So So after about 4 days, she wondered, where does this dog come from? And why does it come to my house? So what she did, she wrote a little note saying, your dog, whoever owns this dog, is coming to my house every day at this time, sleeping for 2 hours. Now, it's very welcome to come. It's a lovely dog. Can you please tell me, you know, where it belongs and why it keeps coming? So she put that note under his collar, and when the dog went home, wherever that was, and it was under the collar, and off the dog went, and he came back the next day with a new note under his collar. And the new note read, now I am the owner of the dog. This dog lives in a house with a nagging wife, 5 children, 2 of which are under 5 years of age. It comes to your house for some peace and quiet. Can I please come too? So even in our today's society, even dogs have become my son place to go to sleep. Like I did today in the temple. So the dog was just so happy, so peaceful and calm up on top of Meditation Mountain. And the meaning I tell that story is because Sam and Vi and the dog, metta, always go together. You can't separate them. So I've actually included not just samatha vipassana, but metta as well. The three of them will always go together. You cannot separate them at all. It's part of what happens on the Eightfold Path. Which is one of the reasons why, if you have a teacher, the teacher will be passionate. Sit up straight for you. Don't talk. You talk. I heard many people talking. It's supposed to be noble silence. That's not method. That's got nothing to do with the path. There is noble silence on this retreat. You know what that no-door silence means? At least I've been practicing this, many of you haven't. No-door silence means, for me anyway, you will hear no bells. That's called no-bell silence. Because monks use this to control you. Get up and walk. Bang! Sit down and get bang! Lunchtime. Bang! Finish. And if you practice, this is a terrible joke, be prepared. If you practice no bell silence, some of you may even win the no bell peace prize. Most of you relax. So samatha vipassana and metta will always go together. And unfortunately, in some traditions of meditation, I don't care whether they call it samatha or vipassana, there's no kindness. You're taught to sit straight for 50 minutes or 45 minutes and get up and walk and sit down again. And if you talk, you are scolded. You will find that those traditions, you'll get so far, maybe as tense as when you started. And people complain to me, my husband went to this retreat and he's worse than when I left. He gets angry at everybody. That shows that something is going on. If it's really good Buddhist meditation, you become more relaxed, more kind, more healthy. This is what meditation is supposed to be about. I tell them, a lot of people, when they've come out to see me the last hour, I don't know what you think I am, but sometimes I think maybe I'm some interrogator working for the CIA in Guantanamo Bay. You're really scared. You're really tense. I don't work for the CIA. I'm not going to hurt you. And that's why when people say anything to me, I always say, very good. We say, I haven't been meditating, I'm a drunkard, I'm a gossip, I take drugs, I run a criminal network. I say, very good. This kind, you've got to embrace a person first of all. Because if you have loving kindness to life, you will find life becomes peaceful. It's nothing to do with life, but everything to do with your reaction to life. Even traumas in your past, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's rape, whether it's cancer, this is part of life, unfortunately. So what are you going to do about it? All those monsters in people's lives are well addressed by that signal I gave you, open the door of your heart, as a monster who came into the Emperor's palace, which comes in the storybook from the Udana, taught by the Buddha. Many of you know that story, but I'm going to say it now because it shows you the importance of metta alongside samatha vipassana and how it works. Once, an emperor was away on some vacation or holiday somewhere, on some business, and while he was away, this terrible monster, this frightening demon, like something you see in the movies but wish you hadn't, came into the emperor's palace. He was so terrified that all the soldiers and guards who were supposed to protect the place, they froze in fear, allowing the monster to come right inside the palace and sit on the emperor's chair.
A big chair, aren't they?
And as soon as he sat down, all the people came to their senses. Get out of here! Who do you think you are? You can't sit in that throne. That belongs to our emperor. Get out! Now those unkind words and thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and the language got worse. That really, really made the guards and ministers in the palace even more upset. Get out! If you don't get out soon, you'll be in big trouble. They made threats, they brought out swords and clubs and everything else. But every unkind word, unkind deed, or unkind thought, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got worse. And that had been going on a long time before the emperor returned. When the emperor returned, he saw in his palace was this huge monster, bigger than half the size of this hall. And it was so ugly, so frightening, that even me, frightened by now, and so smelly, that even the maggots crawling over his skin threw up. And the language was worse, was much worse than when Sri Lanka lost the 2020. I didn't see that in the newspapers. But the emperor was smart. As soon as he saw that demon, he understood what it was. And he said, welcome. Thank you, monster, for coming into my palace. Has anyone got your cup of tea yet? We have wonderful Sri Lankan tea. I call that Theravada tea. Not green tea, that's not a young tea. Or if you prefer, we can have some cabbages, some fruit juice, that's good for your health. A matcha tea, it makes you calm. Or how about something to eat? And those few kind words and kind thoughts, and the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And at that, all the people working in the palace realized their mistake. Instead of giving anger, they gave metta, loving kindness, to the monster. A few of them, about six people, on each foot, gave them a foot massage. Oh, that feels so good. Oh, just over here, said the monster. Just there. Oh, yes, thank you. Oh, that's just nice. Somebody asked if he wanted a pizza. He said, yes, a monster size, please. And they were so busy giving him kindness instead of telling him to get out
that every act of metta, of loving kindness, the dim good, leaves smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And he kept on shrinking until he came to the size where he first came into the palace. But they carried on giving him loving kindness until he became so small, one more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away. And the Buddha told that story, but not about the pizzas or the pork and sausage. I didn't add that part. There's great telling stories that change them. Even if you tell this story to your friends, I don't say it in my words, elaborate it, have fun. And anyway, the Buddha called those monsters anger-eating demons. You feed them anger, get out of here, you don't belong. They get bigger, worse, more of a problem. You all know many anger-eating demons in your life. One of those anger-eating demons may be the husband. Husband, come on, clean up the dishes. You promised to do this tonight. You don't. If you give them anger, what happens? They get bigger, more offensive, more trouble. So don't give them anger. Give them kindness. I love you, husband. You're very nice, husband. Thank you, husband. And if you do that, you can mold your husband into being anything you like. You get angry at them, and they won't do anything. And the same with wives as well, your husband. If you get angry at them, they stand up, my goodness, they actually become like monsters. What is it, I think Shakespeare said, hell knoweth no fury like a woman's wrath. So if you want to go to hell, know how to go to hell. But give them kindness instead, your kids, but more importantly, life. Give that kindness. You know, in Western culture, we've all been exposed to Western culture in the movies these days. They've got the old story of the frog. And one day, I'm going to change it around a bit, because some of these stories are too sexist. A woman was walking past, a very poor girl, and she heard the frog speak. Hey, hey, I'm not really a frog. I'm really a human being who's had a wicked witch put a spell on him because he didn't like me. If you kiss me, I know I'm an ugly frog, but if you kiss me, I will turn into a beautiful boy and I'll do anything you want. I'm very rich, very powerful, whatever you want. I'll be your servant for the rest of your life. And the girl, she wasn't very beautiful, she was plain and a bit plump, but who cares? So she really had nothing to lose. So she kissed that frog. And as soon as she kissed the frog turned into, guess who? Justin Bieber. Who was so weak she didn't like his music. And what was going on? And these days, you've got to change the stories. You can't say that they got married and lived happily after. No. They started a relationship, moved into his mansion, and eventually when they did live, she took half his money. So she did live happily ever after. That is adapting an old fairy story to one touch. Well, just leave it. Why did the Buddhist monk tell that? Because there are many ugly frogs in your life. Sexual abuse when you were a child. Cancers. Really difficult things you had to endure. How do you endure them? What did you do to them? They are ugly frogs. There's a terrible spell that's being put on them by some wicked witches. Kiss them. Embrace them with loving kindness. They're part of your life. You can't get rid of them. You can't pretend it never happened. replace them with loving kindness. And you'll find that that frog turns into this beautiful, beautiful companion. More hot than Justin Bieber. Because it's Dhamma, it's truth. It's not what happened to you in life, but your reaction to it. And the ugliest of frogs, when embraced with loving kindness, can turn into the most wonderful of companions in your life. You give them anger. Why did this happen to me? Who did this? You find it gets worse and worse. That's why metta is as important as samatha vipassana. It all comes together. So you will know, actually this is how I tell how a person's meditation is going. When they come to me and say, oh, I understand this, I understand the Four Noble Truths now, I understand anicca, dukkha, anatta, and the three. Actually, there's another story I told the elders on the way here this morning. Because this is adapting Buddhism to the local culture. And it's wonderful. You know that Buddhism has started to arrive in Western culture when people tell Buddhist jokes. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a pub. If I told it south of the border, I said they're walking to a bar. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta. You know, anicca means impermanence, dukkha means suffering, anatta means no self. Anicca, dukkha, anatta walk into a bar. And dukkha looks around and says, this place is terrible, it sucks. Anicca, doesn't matter, he says to his friend, it's going to change. And anatta turns around and says, who said that? So now you understand what anatta, dukkha, anatta is that, isn't it? It gives you a great teaching. So anyway, sound, vipassana, and metta, they've all worked together. So when people come up and they tell me, had all these understandings, but they're unkind, they're not happy. I say, you haven't understood that. If they say, from now on I'm a sowa, sowa means a stream maker, the first factor in life. And I say, no you're not. What do you mean? If they get angry back, sorry, go back and practice some more. In other words, you find out how much insight a person has by how much metta they have and how still they are. If they can't be still and they haven't got metta, you haven't gone up meditation mountain yet. The sign of insight is stillness and kindness. The sign of stillness. Some people come up to me and say, I've been practicing the jhanas. I want a third jhana now. And I look at them and I tell them, nah, that's not jhana. And they get very upset and angry. Said, I was right. No, sure. If you really got deep stillness, you're incredibly happy. You just can't stop it. That's why when people do come out of these deep meditations, my goodness, they're blissed out. And I've told you this before, I don't mind saying these things. You know, sometimes people think that you are born a monk. Even though my mother did actually say I was born when I came out of her tummy, that was a sign. So, you're not born. I did all sorts of naughty things when I was young. So I know some people are like, I don't want people to look up to you. Don't say this. But I'm going to say, I'm going to be honest. I had a girlfriend, many girlfriends, and I had sex with them. I'm not going to say that, you know, I smoked but not inhaled. I'll be honest with you. So I remember this occasion, one girlfriend, I had sex with her in Gloucester. I was about 19 or 20. And afterwards, I went on a meditation retreat. And I got this incredible, powerful, deep meditation. And because I have to say that, you had sex about a week before, and then had this beautiful meditation, because they were so close together, you could actually compare it. And I thought, my goodness, this meditation is much better than sex. And that was a mind-blowing. Because The first thing I realized, why had no one told me about this before? I've been messing around, trying to find a girlfriend, you know, trying to sort of seduce her, all this other stuff like men do. And there's a much easier way to miss out. You know, it's very expensive having girlfriends when you're a student. And you know, you've got to sort of, you know, talk to her this way, and make deals, and because it's very difficult. So, I don't need one. And also, if you have a girlfriend, you have sex, you know, sometimes she gets pregnant, you have babies, and that's a big trouble. You never have babies when you meditate. So, oh my goodness, this is really something. And from that day on, I realized that this meditation is not just being still and being like some zombie. It's not like being wise and just being, you know, again, like some automaton who never smiles. You realize that when you do get still, when you do understand, you get incredibly happy. And to this day, I always, when people tell me about the insights of meditation, the first thing I look to is the indicator of insight, the indicator of stillness, which is this. That tells me much more about how wise a person is than everything they say. If they're happy, if they smile a lot, I realize, yes, you've got some insight. Now, once I was just mentioning this because there was an article recently, actually just, it's been out for a while now, but it got published recently, that finally the science has found out where the soul lies, where consciousness lies, in the mitochondria of the human brain. And I heard that from this guy, Roger Penrose. He's Sir Roger Penrose, Oxford University, the guy who actually basically discovered black holes. And this is his latest theory, Sir Roger Penrose. And as soon as I heard that from him, I said, look, that can't be right, because that guy's from Oxford. I can't trust those people off. But no, so because I'm still well connected with the science community, especially physics, I know all the professors of physics in Perth, so when he came to visit, I got this invite to have dinner with him. And I looked at him, yeah, he's a brilliant in theoretical physics, but he never smiled. He never could have a conversation with anybody. He was one of these crazy physicists that you probably see in the movies. Socially inept. No partner. He only comes alive when he's in front of a blackboard writing down his equations. And you can understand that, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge there, but no real understanding. You can see that because of his happiness level. If it really is inside peace, it will always be happiness. That's why, if you come to this temple, I actually like this temple. I'm not just saying this because I have to stay here for another couple of days. You know, this was one of the first Vedantic temples I came to in the world where the monks were smiling and happy. I told people that. That's why this is a good temple. I've been to other temples and monks were really fierce and scolding. I say, you're missing out something there. So Samatha Vipassana must always come with happiness. I'll tell you another simile which was very important. Where I live in Australia is on top of a small mountain. I've been in that monastery now in Australia for about 30 years. When we first went there, I told many stories of when we first went there. No money, no land, staying in a small house. I checked the accounts of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia in those days. The house, we had a mortgage for $49,000 Australian dollars. It was worth $50,000. And we were in debt. We had no equity, basically. We were just... And so when we decided, how on earth can we buy some land to build a monastery? So we managed to scrape some land, some money together. And when we bought land for a monastery, we didn't have enough. So there's a loan here, a loan there, you know, putting faith above wisdom. And so we bought that. So, you know, if things had folded, we wouldn't be able to pay off our debts. So we couldn't afford to have builders. So eventually we built the monastery ourselves. I became a builder. And for 7 years I've been living on that property. It was on top of a hill. The reason why we build monasteries on top of hills is because in Western culture, it's not the same as in Asian culture, in Western culture, holy men and women live on top of mountains. You never hear of holy men living in swamps. With the exception of one person. Who's that? Yoda! Yoda lived in a swamp. But that was Hollywood, that's not real life. But real holy men, you have to climb a mountain to see a holy man. And also, I mean, for holy men, that many of you know that I passed my 60th year of birth last year. And so I thought, you know, already you want to invite me back here. Look, I'm over 60, I should be retiring soon. When you retire, you relax and rest, and not have to trouble so much. How old do you have to be to retire in Canada? Only 4 years to go! But no, they said, and when you're a monk, you can't retire. In fact, life begins at 70 for holy men. That's when you really have to start working. So I'm just cruising at the moment. Another few years and you really exploit me. So anyway, our monastery is on top of a hill. So for 7 years, I've been living on top of that hill, always going up and down in a car. One day, it was a beautiful spring morning, I had plenty of time, and my goodness, I did need the exercise. So I decided to walk up that hill. It's about just over 2 kilometres, not that far, but quite a steep hill. As I started walking up that hill in a beautiful sunny morning, it was very strange. I could not recognize my surroundings. This was the hill which led up to my monastery where I had been living for 7 years. And I was seeing things I'd never recognized, I never saw before. So I thought, what is happening here? Something strange is occurring. What is it? So I stopped, stared, and the hillside changed again. And it looked so incredibly beautiful. I started seeing little flowers poking up through the grass. Could actually see now the little stream at the bottom of the valley, where little water was running over the beautiful moss-covered rocks. Even the trees, I could now see their bark, which was beautiful. I saw so much beauty. And I thought, why haven't I seen this before? I've been living up here for 7 years, maybe going up and down 3 times a week in a car. This is the first time I could see the beauty and the detail in this hillside. So as I continued my walk up the hillside, I started contemplating what's happened. And I realized that this is just basic science. When you look through the window of a speeding car, the light which hits the back of your eye, which starts a chemical reaction, which later becomes the sight, it does not have enough time to form a proper image. It can't form details, and the colours are pastel, they're washed out. Before another image comes up, it displaces the first, they have another image, and then another image, and then another image. Which means you miss detail, and the colours aren't rich. So when I went out of the car and started walking, going much slower, I saw so much more. It looked more beautiful. The colours were more full. The detail was there. But nothing could beat standing perfectly still and just looking at that hillside. I'd never seen the grass look so green. It wasn't something supernatural. It was just the image had time to form the complete chemical reaction on the retina to have the full colour green come out instead of having it displayed to another colour and then another image. And the detail was exquisite. I'd never seen that before because my eyes never had a chance to see it. They were always moving too fast. And of course from that I got the seminary of samatha, vipassana, and joy, metta if you like. Sometimes I equate metta, love, with joy, because many people, they interpret joy as this beautiful ultimate love and love with ultimate joy. People have near-death experience, for example, when they go through that life and they go to this place of perfect love, perfect joy. You understand what we mean, because those two come together. Happiness and love coalesce in those states. There's no separation between the two of those. So the joy and happiness which I was feeling was simply because I can now see things as they truly were. And I could see things as they truly were because I stopped moving and was still. And I realized how much of life we spend in a fast car, looking through the window, assuming we understand what's on the other side of that window. We're going too fast. We miss all the detail. And because also we're going so fast, the colors of life are washed out. We can't see the beauty, the depth, and the beautiful texture of life. You have no happiness. So when you really start practicing this Buddhism, samatha, vipassana, metta, all together, it means you're slowing down. Because you're becoming more still, you're out of your car, your fast life, slowing down, you see more, and what you see becomes more beautiful. This happens so often when people have gone on one of my meditation retreats and they go home. They ask their wife, "Darling, when I was away, have you had some makeover? You look so much more beautiful than I am." And the answer is no. She hasn't had the makeover. You've had the makeover. Your senses, your eyes can actually see. You can actually experience the beauty. And you girls who go and meditate, go back home, "Oh, you're such a wonderful husband. You've always been that wonderful husband. You've been going too fast to notice it." It's amazing just how much appreciation, another form of metta, comes when you go still, when you can see things as they truly are. And most importantly, when you go become still, understand your own body of mind. You understand just how beautiful you are. I'm not just saying this, some pop psychologist from over the border. I'm saying this because it's actually true. You begin to love yourself, which is one of the most radical things you can do. You know that there are many people who we call sexual and other deviants in our society. For many years, as a Buddhist, I told you about my girlfriends. I was heterosexual. I was never homosexual or gay. But I will stand up for anybody who is being abused. So I stood up for the gay and lesbian, transgender groups in Australia. And I stood up for them in public, because I was well known, saying, "There's nothing wrong with this. You can be a Buddhist and gay, welcome." And so if any of you have got kids, and they say, "Mum, I'm gay," "Wonderful, darling. I'm so proud of you. And tell all your friends, you know, my son, he's gay." Don't be embarrassed. They'll say, "Oh my God, what am I going to tell my friends?" "Okay, you can be gay, but don't let my friends know." Aren't you Buddhists supposed to have loving kindness and love people for who they are? So at least this is one religion, one path, where you can be accepted no matter who you are. And instead of having something that's an abomination, "Oh, you can come to the temple, we can change you, we can give you therapy to get this disease." Now that really sucks, that's terrible. Please never do that. You're totally accepted for who you are. So because of that, we've got many gay people in our Buddhist community, which is wonderful. I'm so proud of that. And they were very proud, proud that someone actually stood up for them who was religious. Because one person said, "Religion has done a lot of harm to the gay community." So, I was so well regarded that one day I got a personal invitation to attend the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras breakfast. I was so proud of that invitation. I've also been invited to, you know, to dinner with the Queen of England and Australia and Canada as well. Same person, thankfully. And I didn't cherish that as much as my invitation to the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras breakfast. So when you get invitations like that, you go along, and I told everyone, said, I have more deviant than the rest of you. Now, there's heterosexuals and there's homosexuals, and we're the monks, we're celibate. And then many people in our modern world said, that can be cured. They say it's unnatural to be celibate. Just like they said it's unnatural to be gay. So this is the next part of our social revolution. Celibate rights. And it's true, isn't it, sometimes that they're not being unnatural. We say that, and then we want to get rid of it. That's demons in the Emperor's palace again. So sometimes you come up to me, my husband, he's just always so, so argumentative. Argumentative people's rights. So it's part of being a husband, that's what they're like. That's what wives are like. Nah, 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 nah. So when you have that sort of acceptance of all parts of our community, when you have that sense of love and peace, then you are still. So this is actually where I realised from that experience that when you actually do become still, walking up that hill, you do see things you've missed before. That's called insight. And that's always with real insight, it's always accompanied by this feeling of beauty, of love, of acceptance. Even things before you thought were mistakes and flaws. The limbs of the trees were falling off. The grass which was yellow. The rocks which were cracked. You look at those in nature, and that's what makes it beautiful. Without those cracked rocks, without those trees leaning to the left and to the right, you would look like some forest planted by the Canadian government. Not natural. When things are flawed like that, it's called beauty. So what happens with insight? You realize this is beautiful. And what you thought was wrong was a mistake. The abuse which you received as a kid. The faults in your wife or husband. The failures in your life. The little cracked rocks and limbs which have been torn off from the tree. With insight, you look at that. This is really radical. It's beautiful. Wow. It totally changed your attitude to life. You can't change the world. But my goodness, you can change your attitude towards it. That's why I've given so many similes. Like abuse is like someone dumping a whole bucket of shit over your head. You don't deserve that. That's wrong. You shouldn't dump shit. I'm not saying, yeah, dump shit over people. No. But it happens. And when it does happen, which will happen to you somewhere down the line in life, be it divorced, cheated in business, there are all many different types of abuses which happen in life. Thing is, what are you going to do about that? You abuse monks. Maybe you work so hard. We still remember we should start a union. Do you allow unions in Canada? I want work rights for months, hours, so I'm going to work 7 days a week. And retirement, I need retirement benefits. No. Life will be like that. You'll always be abused and things go wrong. It's unfair. Why did you have to get kicked out of your monastery for ordaining bhikkhunis? That's what I did. Who cares? None of us. We all get our abuse from time to time. So, how do you deal with it? And that's where you embrace it. Thank you, Master, for coming into my life. I learned so much from you. That is samatha. Pacifying your reactions to life. You can't calm the world down, but certainly you can calm the reaction to the world. From that calm, you get deep insight. Understanding life. You know it's inside because it makes you happy. You're at peace with the world. You love everybody. I have great fun going into jails, being with prisoners, with rapists, paedophiles, murderers. Actually, I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a paedophile or a rapist or a thief. In all the times I've been in prisons, I've never seen a criminal. What I've never seen are people who have murdered. That doesn't make them a murderer. I've seen people who have stolen. That's not a thief. There's more to them that time they stole. I've seen a person who's a rapist. And they're not a rapist, sorry, but they've raped. They've done many other things in their life as well. You know, a weird thing happens when you see the whole person rather than one or two terrible acts for which they've been put in jail. You're not saying those acts are good, they're terrible. They're so hurtful. But there's more to them than that. If you focus on the faults, especially if you focus on that person, you're a murderer. That's what they're going to show you back. What you see in others is what they see in themselves, and that's who they become. So I've never seen a murderer. I've seen people who've murdered. When I see that, people, they show me the other part of them. They're wonderful people. And they see that in themselves. They never do it again. If you call a person a paedophile, they will re-offend. It's obvious to me. If you see the other part of themselves, you know why people keep going back to jail? I'm a murderer, I'm a rapist, I'm a thief. They feel so bad about themselves, they lose all their self-esteem. There's no purpose for them trying to do anything else. You do know a person, see the other part of them. They have self-esteem, so that destructive behaviour to others disappears. And I've got one of my best comments ever, not from any of you, it was from this prison officer. And this prison officer called me some years ago and said, can you come back to teach in my prison? And I said, I'm so busy, I have to go to Toronto and all these other places. And he went, no, we want you to come back to our prison. I said, look, I'll send another man. No, he said, we want you. And of course, I said, why me? And then he gave me one of my most cherished compliments I've ever received. He said, because I've been a prison officer for my whole life. This is my career. I'm shortly to retire after 30 or 40 years of service. So I've noticed something unique in your classes. Everyone who came to your class never ever comes back to jail again. That can be so good. They've always, once they're released, they get a life. And when I thought afterwards, what have I done? What special thing has this Buddhist practice given that people in these terrible situations in their life, they leave the jail and they get a life? It's obvious. Because I never saw the faults in these people. It means they didn't focus on the faults themselves and the other part of them were. Remember telling this story, that story, in, where was it? In Singapore, the Institute of Mental Health, which was having their 50th anniversary or something, so they asked me to give a keynote address. I love giving talks in places I've never been to before. Or in situations, like I mentioned earlier, I gave a keynote at a World Computer Conference 2 years ago. I know nothing about computers. But just because you don't know what you're talking about doesn't stop me from talking. Okay, I enjoyed myself. Okay. So I don't know much about mental health. So I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I've got no medical degree. My degree is in theoretical physics. So I went out there and I told that story about the prisoners, about mental health in the jail, and how you focus on the nice side of them, and the bad side just disappears. And then this guy came up to me, he said, "Look, I'm a Christian, but I want you to bless my facility, and this big campus of mental health in Singapore." So I said, "Sure, I'll bless anything for a cup of tea." So then, as we were walking, I said, "What is your unit anyway?" "It's the schizophrenia unit." And they said, "How do you treat schizophrenia in your unit?" He said, "Exactly as you were just talking about. In fact," he said, "we don't treat schizophrenia in my schizophrenia unit. We treat the other part of the patient." I realized he understood something very profound. And even though in monastic tradition we're not supposed to do this, I raised my hand and worshipped that man. I said, "Wonderful. So inspiring." And I knew the answer to my next question. What's the result? I said, "So much better than you'd ever expect from medication." Well, that's how you treat a schizophrenia patient. You don't treat them as a schizophrenic. As a person, a huge being, who has much more than schizophrenia. So don't just focus on the sickness. They're a person. Whole being there. If you focus on the person or the sickness, they become even more sick. That's what you become. Now that insight. And how the hell does a monk know that? Why is a monk teaching people about marriage? I've never been married. I gave a talk 2 weeks ago in Perth on parental alienation, how to deal with kids. I never had any kids. I gave a talk, once I went to this, because I wanted members of the public, I went to this conference in Australia on transport issues. You know, trucks on the roads, should be lorries. You know what difficult that is and how controversial that is. So, I went to that conference too. And what anyone else was having lunch, because it was after 12 and I was too late for my lunch, I got interviewed by a transport magazine. It was actually a shipping magazine. I always remember this. So this guy came up to me and said, "Can I interview you? Because I was interested in your comments about shipping." So I answered all these questions. I know absolutely nothing about shipping. I have been on a ship before, but that's about my extent of shipping and transport. And I gave all this interview, and the guy disappeared. And he came up about a year later, and I said, "Do you remember me? I was that guy who interviewed you at that transport company. And that article on shipping," he said, "that went viral." And I called it, Zen and the Art of Shipping. And he got all these email facts from these, transport professors and stuff. He said, "Who is this Ajahn Pal? Who is this?" "I don't know who he is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about." I don't know anything about shipping. That's what he's talking about. But when you have insight, you can understand basic principles of life. That's what insight is. It solves problems. It doesn't make new ones. It creates calm. It creates love and happiness. So samatha vipassana, all this intellectual argument, which did you do? Samatha is the best vipassana. Which one leads to enlightenment? Look, eightfold path leads to enlightenment. Not just insight. People say insight, that's the seventh factor. Just be mindful and you become enlightened. And all the other seven factors they forget about. Right speech, no. Just when you're scolding, calling someone a pig, just be mindful. It's much more than just being mindful. I'm going over time, I don't mind. I just had a cup of coffee beforehand. So sure. There was a wealthy person here in Toronto, living in one of these mansions with guards at the gate. So, they came to the temple this evening to hear my talk. But before they came, they told the guard, "Look, there's many burglars and bad people here in Toronto, targeting mansions like mine. They may know that, I'm away this evening. So please, guard, be mindful." So she came to the temple. When she went back home, she found her house had been robbed. The burglars have been in. So she asked the guard on her house, I told you to be mindful, we've been robbed. But madam, I was mindful. I was very mindful. I saw the burglars going in, and I noticed, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking your jewellery out, and I noticed, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I looked at them going back in again. Burglars going back in. I saw the safe coming out, safe going out, safe coming out. I was mindful, madam. Is that a wise guard? It's not just being mindful, it's being kind enough to do something about it. Call the police for goodness sake. But I was mindful, man, I was mindful. So that's sometimes you guys. You're meditating and your legs are hurting. Pain, pain, pain. Ambulance, ambulance, ambulance. Don't be crazy. Be kind. If it's pain, move. For those on this meditation retreat, if you feel like coughing, cough straight away. Because in meditation retreats, otherwise we get what I've called the volcano effect. You suppress it. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cough. I'm not going to cough. I'm not going to cough. When you do cough, when that volcano blows, you can hear it in the clinic next door. You can hear it in the other side of Toronto. It's so loud. And also, you spray all this blood of the people around you, which is really unhealthy. Just cough. Get it out of the way. So you can actually see that sometimes you need to be kind, to be peaceful, to be wise. The three of them go together. And that's the path to enlightenment. So don't just think, no, I'm doing samatha. You're not. You're doing vipassana and metta at the same time. It's all the same mountain. You always go together. There's no differentiation there. So don't think, I should do samatha first and then vipassana. No. Do all three together. Which you must always do. If you get calm, you see. If you see, you get happy. If you get happy, you must be calm. It solves problems. If you're happy with your husband, happy with your wife, it solves the problem of divorce lawyers. So it calms things down, makes things feel very peaceful and calm and happy and insightful. So that's actually how you know which one's which. It's just one single path, which makes it very efficient. Now, because I see there's a Mahayana nun sitting in there, you'd be on the front here, you're on the nun for goodness sake. Sometimes it will work. Okay, samatha vipassana, we've dealt with that. What about all the different forms of Buddhism? Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Which is the best? So you do Theravada first, and once you complete the Theravada, then go to the highest stage of Mahayana, become a Bodhisattva. And then once you become a Bodhisattva, go to the highest stage of Thor, of Vajrayana, which is supposed to be the highest path. Anyone who says, my path is better than your path, is an egotistic, arrogant, conceited pig. I don't care who they are. Can't people see that when they say, my path is better than your path? That's conceit, that's arrogance. Or my religion is better than your religion. When Buddha was asked, in other religions, can you become enlightened? The Buddha's very wise answer said, in whatever religion, cult, path, whatever, you find the eightfold path and you become enlightened. It's not what group you belong to, Theravada, forest tradition, Sri Lankan tradition, Siam Nikaya, Ramanya Nikaya, blah blah blah. It doesn't matter what Nikaya you belong to, or what religion you belong to. It's what you do, how you practice. That's what makes you enlightened or not. It's the path, not the label. So because of that, to create more harmony between all the Buddhist traditions and other traditions as well, I made my own tradition. To combine everybody. So I took the three major Buddhist traditions, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, combined them all. And I took the H from Hinayana, that's Theravada. the hate from Hinayana, the aha from Mahayana, and the yana from Vajrayana. Now put them all together, what does that spell? Hahayana. Yes, you are Hahayana. Anybody who laughs is now officially a Hahayana person. That's my tradition. Welcome to the Hahayana. So, and that's profound, it's not just a joke. When people are happy, it shows they have insight. It shows them how to be still. When you walk up that mountain of life, get out of your cars and go slowly. When you stop, you see things as they truly are, gives you so much happiness and joy. Enlightenment is the highest happiness, said the Buddha. Nirvana paramasukha. So Hahayana is a part of Nirvana. So I've been talking too much. It's great to have some questions now. Any Q&A? So, who's going to ask a question? If you have to go, please, you can go at any time. You won't offend me. I'm the hardest monk in the whole world to offend. Yes.
Venerable Sirs, in Pandey, you have laid out so succinctly, so clearly, the substance, the essence of Buddha Dhamma, like one would imagine Lord Buddha would have done, with homely examples and anecdotes that kept us in humor as well as in deep devotion and made us think. Monday in Toronto, in the GTA, we have had Buddhist temples. I'm talking of Sri Lankan initiated Theravada temples for the last 33 years. There is one point that frustrates us, and that is, after all these 33 odd years, this temple, 20 years here, we have not been able to persuade or inspire our young children, adults, to leave the household life and become Buddhist monks, dedicating their lives, in other words, to a vocation.
Yeah.
Now this has crossed our minds as to why it does not happen. And my own conclusion is that our traditional ways, the traditional aspects of Theravada Buddhism that we practice in Sri Lanka or here, a prototype of it here, it seems to impede, our progress.
Yeah.
Could you please advise us as to how we may entice, it's the wrong word, but inspire our young people to go into the life of a Buddhist monk and become monastic? Because judging by you, we find that we want more of your caliber among our youth. Thank you.
Very good. Okay. Now, I noticed from your question, number one, you just asked about more of our young men. You have left out half the human population. What about your young women as well?
I do. Finally, one day, I do aim to, in fact,
because
women,
women,
great part of my question. Okay, thank you.
So you support the regrowth of the nuns' order here in Buddhism. And to support that, doesn't be saying, oh yeah, I agree with that. Get out your checkbooks and write donations. Because otherwise, say, for example, my temple over in Perth, there's a Buddhist nuns' monastery in California, which is much closer to you. There's many young women, great women, who are trying to become bhikkhunis. They don't get much support at all. They would love a temple like this. Why is it that all you Sri Lankan men and women, Malaysian, Singaporean, Chinese men and women, give your donations to monks' monasteries who are already very big, and the monks are very fat, while the bhikkhunis are struggling? So if you think that's what you want to do, you have got to sacrifice something to do it. I've done my sacrifice. I've been kicked out of the monastery while I pray. I've done my bit as best as much as I can. Now it's up to you. Please support the nuns. It's historical. After so many centuries in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, in the West, we're rebuilding the half of Buddhism which has been lost. And it's wonderful to be part of that. But I just can't do much more. Please, you have to support. So I know, now, temples here will be getting upset at me. Yeah, you probably have some debts to pay off for this temple here, which is great, being used. But please also do the same for the bhikkhunis, the nuns. They are striking because they're beginning. They haven't got much support. And then number one, in the West, when they see that men and women are being treated equally, as the Buddha hoped, number one, they will say, yes, this is a religion I can feel proud of. One of the young men who ordained with me 2 years ago, he asked permission from his mother. He's a young man, 23, 24, can I become a monk without your father? And his mother in Holland didn't know anything about Buddhism and said, do they treat women as fairly as they treat, with fairly as equally as with men? He said, imagine what else might should they do, because this is what he did. He said, okay, I'll give my blessing. Otherwise, I would not. In a place like Canada, if Buddhism does not, if your temple does not treat people equally, if it does not treat gay and other minorities equally with respect and love, Buddhism will die. This is modern culture. It's not actually modern culture, it's ancient culture as well. I've heard that, say, in India, where Buddhism started, there was never any cultural obstacle to, say, homosexuality. It was totally accepted and respected as a natural part of human life. There was something in 1850 or 56, the Viceroy of India at that time, a guy called Lord Macaulay, introduced a law in India, basically coming from the British Raj, saying that homosexuality is unnatural, therefore it is illegal. They imposed that culture on an Indian culture which was so tolerant and loving and accepting. And it's only now, apparently, this is why I heard it, the Indian government are trying to repeal all those oppressive laws. They say, no, come on, off you go, if you want to do that, fine. Even gay marriage. What's wrong with two people of any gender getting married? So I've gone on record, I've gone up and put submissions to the Australian government. What's wrong with gay marriage? If two people want to love each other, I don't care who they are, I'd rather have a couple of gay people married in my temple who are honest, have a good relationship with each other and trust each other, than having a husband and wife who cheat on each other. So please, you can join my temple. And I'm just waiting for the first day this can become legal, so I can actually be there, and I'll bless your servant. I'll come all over the world to bless your servant if you want me. That's how much I support this. On those social issues, when the Buddhist monks and the leaders stand up for those social issues, then more of your young people will say Buddhism is relevant. We do have a powerful voice, just don't use it. Let's get more controversial. The death penalty. Is there a death penalty current in Sri Lanka on the statute books?
There's a
Yes, it is there. That is a shame on Sri Lanka as a Buddhist nation. Did the Buddha encourage killing people? The very first precept is say no. So why don't the Buddhist monks stand up and say, repeal the death penalty? Even if it's not used, it's still there. You know, there's people who, another person who was a gay activist, he told me how to do social action. In Tasmania, which is a small province of Australia, or actually what the Tasmanians say, that Australia is a small island off Tasmania. For many years, there was a law which said homosexual practice, even between consenting adults, is illegal. And so the gay activists kept on saying, look, repeal that law. They said, look, don't worry about it. We'll never enact it. We'll never actually prosecute you for that. So that's not the point. The law is there. It's disrespect, no, to the gays. Repeal it. So the government refused to repeal that law. They said, oh, we won't punish anyone for that. So what the gays did, they got about 100 active gay couples, and they agreed one particular night they would have as much sex as they possibly could together, and they would record it all in detail, and the following morning they all went to the local police station to hand themselves in for breaking the law. With the media in tow. And the police had no choice. They had to arrest them. They've broken the law. The police can't decide who gets prosecuted or doesn't. So they confessed, and they had this big list of what they did the last night. They handed the police and they said, look, we've broken the law, we're handing ourselves in. And about 100 couples. For the next couple of days, the law was repealed. Because the government was embarrassed. It's amazing what you can do to governments to embarrass them, to make them responsive to people. So even death penalty. And when there's a little bit more, it's not politics, but monks and nuns and Buddhists standing up for what is obviously socially unethical, you get many, many more young people involved. Buddhism is not just, we've got that part of ourselves which stays in the forest and meditates. But just like the Buddha, we've got people who are concerned about the ethics of the kings and the governments. And young people, they've got a world they want to live in. So all right for you old guys, you're out of here soon. The young people have got to live with this planet. That makes it much more relevant to young people. So it's true. Keep the essence of Buddhism, which is very easy to keep. All the cultural accretions, you can let go of those. All of the superstitions which we have, all the strings which you work, the pyramid thread. Does that, how many of you got pyramid thread on your hands? Does that work? Have you ever seen anybody die in a hospital with tons of pyramid thread on your? Oh, come on, those are the sorts of things in Thailand have all these amulets on. You see, they have some of these Buddha's amulets around their neck. It causes them no spinal problems. Is that going to work? Of course not. So be careful of superstition. That has nothing to do with original Buddhism. Sorry, I'm going off too far.
No, there is a question from fans over there. Please explain why Yonasa Manasikara, it's a Pali term, is not translated properly as their attention or proper attention, wise attention, etc. And going into the source of things is a better way to understand the term.
Okay, that was my rendering of that term. Now, yoni means womb. Manasikara literally means work of the mind which goes back to the source of things. Goes inside rather than onwards. And that is a term which is where insight comes from. To go to the source of things, you have to keep things still so the outer things disappear and you go deeper and deeper into things. That's where you find the truth of things. Bare attention does not work. It's not bare attention. You are attending to the things you want to see. You're in denial of the things you don't like to see. Take an example. When you go out with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you do not have bare attention. Maybe when you go to bed afterwards, it's bare attention, but not all night. Bare attention, you think of what I see is what's real. In Buddhism, as I'll tell you later on during this retreat, you have to overcome the five hindrances before you can trust what you see, what you hear, what you know. Those hindrances are what bend the truth. Desire bends the truth. You see what you want to see. A good example of that is when there is an LBW appeal against the Sri Lankan batsman. If you're a Sri Lankan, that's not out. Who's going to miss the stumps? Because you see what you want to see. The opposite, that's clear, that's part LBW. Give it out. Even in simple cases like that, you see what you want to see, you don't see what you don't like to see. So bare attention does not work. You have to get rid of all desire and ill will. So you don't ever see what you don't want. You don't ever see what you want to see, nor do you reject what you don't like seeing. You see even stuff which is really challenging to you. That means to be still. Then you see things as they truly are. I mentioned earlier in this retreat this morning, it really belongs to Vipassana Samatha. If there's a lake in the mountains, if there's even one ripple on that lake, it will not reflect the stars and the moon in the sky above. It will distort the image. Let alone if there's waves on the surface. Only when that lake is perfectly still, would it give a true reflection of the heavens above. In the same way, only when your mind is perfectly still will you see things as they truly are. Will you have attention which tells the truth. Otherwise, it's always bent and distorted. Yoni Samana Sikara, this work of the mind which goes to the source, depends on stillness. Without stillness, I would never be able to see that hillside and see how beautiful it is. Then be able to look at a murderer and see how beautiful they are. And see they're not a murderer, but just a person. Then be able to look at a gay and realise they're a person, they're a being. That's just how they express themselves. And be able to love them totally and accept them. Yoni Samana Sikara goes to the thought, means even you can respect and love Adolf Hitler. I went to Germany recently, really stirred people up. Said, everybody else, yes, but not here. There's a story about Adolf Hitler. Just after the Berlin Wall fell, a few days later, a private aircraft landed in Rio de Janeiro airport. In the middle of the night, they taxied, not to the terminal, but to the end of the runway, where a limousine with blackened windows was waiting for them. A few gentlemen came out of the aircraft into the limousine and went through a rear gate in the airport to a guarded mansion in the suburbs of Rio. And there they went through the gate, knocked on the door, and this little old lady answered the door. That's nice. I must have music together with my wife. It gives my background. The little old lady answered the door. And then the two men from Germany said, is your husband in? She said, yeah, but he's arrested. Eva, we need to see your husband. So a few seconds later, this old man with his little moustache came to the door. And the two men outside, Heil Hitler. He said, Heil. And he said, mein Führer, who never really died, went to Rio. My Führer, it's time for the fourth Reich. The world is down, Germany is united, there's economic chaos, we need a strong leader like you. He said, no, I've been there, done that. He said, no, we really need you, reconsider. So he said, give me a few moments, I'll talk it over with my wife. So Adolf and Eva, they discuss the matter. And they come back again, and they told the two gentlemen from Germany, I've reconsidered. I'll do it, but on one condition. This time, no more Mr. Nice Guy. That's a joke. I don't mean to say no more Mr. Nice Guy. Anyway.
Last question.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
In your book, just beginning to learn about it, that when meditate, your mind becomes still, and at one point you stop hearing and experiencing outside
Yeah.
When that happens, what happens if you are meditating? How do you know when to come out of it?
Okay. When you're on a meditation retreat, it's truly something. You get so still, you're inside yourself, you can't hear sounds outside. But I guarantee that when it's lunchtime, you'll know. It's amazing, psychic ability, they always come out. Now, if you haven't done this before, it's a nice little test for you, little experiment. Tonight, when you go to bed, you're comfortable in your bed and about to go to sleep, and you have to decide when you're going to wake up in the morning. So say you're waking up at 6 o'clock. Set your alarm this evening to 6:05, just in case. And tell yourself as you're going to sleep, I will wake up at 6 a.m. I will wake up at 6 a.m. I will wake up at 6 a.m. In your own words, repeat it 3 times. Be aware of what you're saying, and then forget it and go to sleep. First time I did that, I was amazed. You know, 1 or 2 minutes either side of 6 o'clock, I'd wake up, open my eyes, what time is it? 6 o'clock. It's just how you program your brain. It works. The first time you do that, you think, oh, this is weird. But then you understand this is how your brain works. So that's what you do when you go into deep meditation. I must get up before lunch. I must get up. It works. Okay, another question, or is it too long? Because usually, when I give talk, we have 3 last questions. We have the last question, and the very last question, and the very, very last question.
Thank you very much for coming to Toronto. I have a quick question. In the Buddhist text, it is stated that only a man could become a Buddha.
And
I've had a question about this, because I wonder what about female physical form makes it impossible to reach Buddhahood, because they are talking about female physical form, whereas the way I understand it, realization of truth is not related to your physical form.
Exactly. It's really unfair, isn't it? And it's also untrue. Yeah, it does say that, but that is contextual. From the time of the Buddha in India, if you were a woman in the time of the Buddha in India and became fully enlightened, people wouldn't believe you because you didn't have the same status in society as a man did. Now in Canada, everyone is given the same status, just about. There's still work to do, as you well know, but it's much, much better. So if a Buddha decided to take rebirth in Toronto, it wouldn't really matter. He would still be able to get the best results, even in a woman's body, because you have the social equality to a certain extent. It also helped to take birth in a royal family in the time of Buddha. That gave you more respect as well. Today, if you want that respect, the Buddha will probably get reborn in the family of a rock star as a girl, and then you get much more coverage. Which is important if you're going to spread the Dhamma. And maybe, sometime in the future, as there has been in history before, there's been matriarchal societies which have been led by females. And in that society, certainly the Buddha would be reborn as a woman. Because being reborn as a man would give him no leverage. It wouldn't be the best vehicle to teach. He only took birth in a male body, because obviously the best body he could use, the most effective at that time, to spread his message. That's cultural at that time. So the Buddha said, well, this sort of society, yes, only men can become Buddhas in this society, because that's the only way they can really teach. Nowadays, no. So, it's common sense to me. The great thing about Buddhism is you don't get sort of hand-drawn and quartered by interpreting the teachings, as long as you keep the essence. This is not a faith-based religion, where if you don't believe what is written by God in some book, then you'll get in big trouble. So yes, these are the teachings of the Buddha. We know what the Buddha said, pretty much, but we have to understand what he meant. To understand what he meant, you have to actually experience those teachings. And then they make so much sense. And it makes Buddhism a very powerful religion. Because the texts are not, what's the word? Dogma, which you have to believe at all costs. That's the trouble with many other religions. They're stuck. I know many other religious leaders who get really upset. But the Bible says that homosexuality is an abomination. That's what it says. I don't believe that. The book says it is. They have this great conflict inside. You know, their books tell them one thing, their hearts tell them another. And what should you believe? Always your hearts. Don't believe the books. Never allow your knowledge or your learning to stand in the way of truth. It's one of the sayings which I quote. Truth takes precedence over learning and knowledge. And that's Kalama Sutta, if you like. So it doesn't matter what the monk says. What your heart says is more important. Does it feel like it's true? A woman, she can't become a Buddha? Does that feel right? Of course it doesn't. That's a good indicator it's not right. It needs to be interpreted. The very last question. This is the very, very last question.
Ajahn, this is not a question, it's just some information that follows on from your earlier remarks. There's a fledgling Canadian Buddhist nuns hermitage struggling to get off the ground right here in Ontario.
Aha! Can you please?
The name of it is Sati Saraniya.
What is that again?
Sati Saraniya.
Pardon?
Sati Saraniya.
I say it three times, people might remember it.
It's led by someone you may know, Ayametanandi.
Ayametanandi, a very good nun.
Yeah.
So, how do you make directions to them?
Well, if you go to the website, you Google Sati Saraniya Hermitage, you'll find the website. And you'll discover that they're in the midst of constructing their meditation hall, and they're struggling to get the money together to complete the construction. So you could help the first Canadian Buddhist nuns hermitage to get off the ground.
Really good. Now, why you should help that is as follows. In the Mahakamavibhanga Sutra, I'm quoting this because, you know, many of you have faith in the Buddha's teachings, as in the suttas. People ask the Buddha about making good karma. Basically, you've only got a certain amount of money. Where can you get the biggest bang for your bucks with donations? And he said, giving donations to a monk or a nun, even if they're an arahat, fully enlightened, is never, ever, in any circumstances, more meritorious than giving to a Sangha. Giving to a Sangha is much higher bang for your bucks. He said the highest bang for your bucks is giving to both sanghas with the Buddha at its head. Now, he said, once the Buddha has passed away into Parinibbana, the highest merit you can get from making a donation is to the sangha of both genders. So, you have the opportunity to make the highest karma possible by your donations here in Ontario. In BC, they don't have that. In Quebec, they don't have that. You are so lucky that you have the opportunity of getting the best rewards for your donations. Now we have the two sanghas. So please look, make Buddhism relevant for the future. Don't just sit and say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay? So go and see that gentleman. Give your name, your bank account details. But my master, Ajahn Chah, he gave this story to open the door of your heart. I told this story last Sunday. We had Arkansas ceremony. You have Arkansas ceremony here soon? Coming week. I told him the story of this man from Sydney who, when he heard that my master Ajahn Chah was a very powerful and wise monk, he wanted to see him personally. So he travelled all the way from Sydney to Thailand, not to go touring around, just for one purpose only, to see this great master. When he got to Bangkok, he found this monk living in Bangkok, was up in the provinces, got a train to the provinces, found a taxi to take him to the monastery outside of the head city of the province. And when he got to the monastery, where is Ajahn Chah? He was in that day, he was very lucky, so he went to his hut and he was surrounded by as many people as here today. He was waiting on the outside to ask his question, waiting 2 or 3 hours. Ajahn Chah was too busy. He was too popular. So this Australian, Caucasian from Sydney, he got up to go home, realizing he wouldn't have any power, opportunity to ask his question, which was really important to him, even though he'd come from such a long way. As he was walking back to his taxi, he realized it was another half an hour before his taxi would arrive. And he saw some of the monks and lay people cleaning the temple. That's really important that you clean the temple. It's good karma, always good things happen to you. So don't just after this talk, just go home. Clean the temple. Look after it. Because this guy, he was cleaning the temple, doing some sweeping. And as he was busy sweeping, he felt a hand on his shoulder. Wondered who it was, turned around, it was Ajahn Chah. This great monk, even though he was surrounded by many people, he noticed this guy, he realized he'd come such a long way. Ajahn Chah was going off to another appointment outside. On his way to his own car, he stopped by this Westerner to give him some advice. And this Westerner said, this advice has made him so successful and happy. He said, the best advice ever he'd ever got from anywhere. Very simple, very practical. Ajahn Chah told him, if you're going to be sweeping, give it everything you've got. Don't just go thinking about what you're going to do next. Mindful, energized, innocent life. If you're sweeping, give it everything you've got. He realized it's not just about sweeping, it's about the whole of life. If you're meditating, give it everything you've got. Don't think about much afterwards, then you're only giving it half. If you're working, give the work, the project in front of you, everything you've got. If you're resting, sleeping at night, just sleep everything you've got. Don't think about the work tomorrow. If you are playing, enjoying yourself, talking with your friends, give it everything you've got. Don't feel guilty about that. It's part of life, socializing. If you're having a party with your girlfriend, everything you've got. He said, that teaching, whatever you're doing, give it everything you've got. He said, made him a rich person, spiritually happy, great relationship. He said, that was advice for life. Such a simple teaching. You're going out with a girl, you're going with your wife, give it everything you've got. You'll always be successful. And I told that story at Arkansas and said, if you're going to make a donation, give it everything you've got.
So there you go.
Okay. Very good.
I think that's it for today. We have been here for almost 9 hours. So we have two more days for the retreat. So thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for your wonderful wisdom. And there will be a short, at a half an hour, book signing. So please keep it short. You don't engage in conversation with Ajahn because it will cost a lot of time. So before you go, as Ajahn Brahm said, clean the temple is a good thing. So keep it everything neat and clean for tomorrow, so before you go. Thank you.
Very good.
Tomorrow,